We are extremely fortunate to have Sarah Rosenbaum as our first speaker. She is the Harold and Jane Hirsch Professor and Founding Chair of the Department of Health Policy at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, a unique center of learning, scholarship, and service focusing on all aspects of health policy. Professor Rosenbaum has devoted her career to issues of health law and policy affecting low-income, minority, and medically underserved populations, as well as the healthcare safety net. Between 1993 and 94, Professor Rosenbaum worked for President Clinton, directing the legislative drafting of the Health Security Act and developing the Vaccines for Children program. Professor Rosenbaum also served on the presidential transition team for President Obama. A graduate of Wesleyan University and Boston University School of Law, Professor Rosenbaum has authored more than 250 articles and studies focusing on all phases of health law and health care for medically underserved populations. She is co-author of Law and the American Healthcare System and has won many national awards for her scholarship and service, including the Richard and Barbara Hansen National Health Leadership Award, a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Investigator Award in Health Policy Research, and the Oscar and Shoshana Trachtenberg Award for Scholarship, the George Washington University's highest faculty award. So I'd like you to please join me in welcoming Dr. Rosenbaum to give the first presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here today. I don't use slides. I think those of us who are legally trained and of a certain age never made it into visuals. So I'm just going to talk to you for a few minutes and hopefully leave a couple of minutes at the end for questions. My charge was to give you an overview of national health reform and to do so in about 15 minutes, focusing on its implications for immunization and immunization policy. Putting together a 15-minute presentation on national health reform is, of course, not an easy task. It's one of those things that you could stand up and talk about for probably for the rest of your life. I don't know if anybody in the room is a theater aficionado, but the only thing I can really compare this to is seeing this wonderful show called Reduce Shakespeare. If you ever have a chance to go see it, you should, where they do all of his plays in 90 minutes. So it's sort of on a par with Reduce Shakespeare. I've organized my remarks into really three main categories. The first one being, what is the ultimate goal of health reform? Not so much focusing on our nation's goal, this particular Congress, but in general, what does a country think of? What is it aiming for when it moves into health reform mode? The second set of questions is what policy dials need to move to get this country from the state we're in now into a reformed health mode? What do we need to change? And the third category, of course, is what pathway are we likely to choose? What kind of timetable are we on? How many of those dials will we be able to move in the time that we're allotted, which is probably this first year of the president's term? Generally speaking, when a president wants to accomplish major goals, given the compressed nature of society, it means that the White House is on a tear to get things done in the first year, and this will be no exception. One can expect that everybody will be putting pedal to the metal. We're here in Texas where the speed limit used to be, long time ago, cautious and prudent. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But in this case, the aim is to get something done by the end of this year. So what's the goal of health reform? This is a big question. It's a big question for any country to ask. And particularly in this country where our system is so fractured, so without the kind of discipline that a nation has to have in order to make sure that it has a health system that functions well for everybody. The Institute of Medicine probably said it best a number of years ago, the goal of any healthcare system, of course, is to get the right care in the right place at the right time to the right people. And that's true whether it's basic clinical care, such as immunizations, or very, very advanced care for people with very serious health conditions. I would say we know enough now to add a second goal as a true social goal, and it's one that is every bit as important as the first goal. The first goal is obviously the right care, the right place at the right time. The second goal is to be able to see how we're doing as a society, to be able to know whether we are achieving the goals of right care, right place, right time for the population as a whole, and particularly for subpopulations who are in need of special systems and supports in order to be able to take full benefit of a healthcare system. In the immunization context, quite frankly, what it really means is being able to assure that every child and adult in the United States is fully immunized according to scientific recommendations, that is, the recommendations of the ACIP, and in so doing to reduce the burden of preventable illness and death. In order to reach this kind of goal, one needs to look at moving a whole bunch of dials or policy levers. It's not just a matter of putting an insurance card into people's hands, although that's a big part of it. Insurance makes an enormous difference in access to care, whether it's preventive care or advanced care. But there are really a few basic goals that have to come up in any reform system. One is to get people covered and to keep them covered. It's not enough just to make it possible for people to enroll and give them a card. You have to keep them covered. Now, in societies in which insurance is simply part of your status as a member of that society, and once you have it, you don't lose it, it's a little bit easier. In this country, because our system is so fractured, we're going to have to move into a world sort of slowly, or hopefully not so slowly, but with care, into a world in which people enroll in coverage and keep that coverage. And even if they change jobs or move or have a fluctuating income, they don't lose the coverage. And so what that means is developing a system in which care, in which coverage is accessible, in which it's highly affordable, heavily subsidized for lower income people. It's totally portable so that if you have any change in status, your coverage travels with you. There are no breaks in coverage, and of course, the system is accessible to everybody. It also means having coverage that's the right coverage. So, as would be relevant to this conference, it means having coverage that includes the full range of ACIP-recommended vaccines with point of service cost sharing that is considered totally affordable. So nominal co-payments at most, no deductibles applied to preventive benefits to go along with premiums that are considered affordable. In the US, to get to this goal is a tremendous challenge because we have literally countless specific coverage arrangements within numerous major categories. If you stop and think, every employer health plan is a different coverage arrangement. So the employer health plan for state of Texas health department employees is a plan. The plan that covers the federal workers who are here is a plan. My plan at the George Washington University is a plan. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of plans. But if we think about it, they can be grouped into a few major categories. There are plans that are sponsored by employers. There are plans that are offered publicly, such as Medicare and Medicaid. We can think of them as a plan. And the real test of reform is what to do about people who don't have one of those three pathways, who right now are relying on the individual market or who work for small employers who simply can't get affordable coverage. The goal of reform is to create a fourth pathway. You could think of it as a fourth layer in a four-layer cake, really, is to create a group mechanism that will reach those people so that whether your pathway is Medicare, Medicaid, employer-sponsored benefits, or a new fourth pathway, you will be able to have group coverage that has the kinds of features I mentioned. It's stable. You don't have to change your source of coverage just because you move. You may have to enroll in a new coverage arrangement if you move to a different state. But regardless of your income or your position in society, your coverage travels with you. And for purposes of this conference, it covers immunizations in an affordable way. There are other dials, though, that have to be moved. That's the most complicated, and that's the one that's going to get the most attention. The other dials that will have to be moved is a national system of information reporting and performance measurement. We've started to make some of those changes with the health information technology reforms that were part of the Reinvestment and Recovery Act. We also have to move payment dials. It's not enough to just insure people. You have to figure out how you're going to pay providers in a way, and this is the great lesson of VFC. It wasn't just about insuring children. The coverage was already there. VFC's great contribution to vaccine policy was understanding that you also have to worry about the supply side, you have to worry about the management side of vaccines, you have to take away the disincentives on the part of clinical providers against furnishing vaccines without any missed opportunities. And so there are payment issues, administration issues, vaccine stocking issues that would need to be thought about. There's also the matter of system support. Insurance and a place to get health care works for many of us. There will always be a part of the population that faces additional barriers as a result of language, limited health literacy, geographic isolation, other isolation, for whom access is a problem. So there we need to think about workforce supply, we need to think about public health infrastructure, we need to make sure that there are no missed opportunities to enable people to use their insurance coverage well and use it early. Now, what do we think is going to get put into place this year? If we're lucky, we will deal with this fourth layer, and we will lay the groundwork, a little bit of groundwork laying, for the first couple of layers. You could think of it as sort of building a skeleton. We are not going to come to the end of 2009 with health reform all done, okay? What we're going to do is build a skeleton, and there are certain pieces of the skeleton that are key at this point. One is, of course, the fourth layer. Two is definitions of what it means to be covered and what it means for coverage to be affordable. We need those terms defined for the American people, particularly if, as many people suspect, there may be a requirement of coverage. People need to be assured that their coverage will be available and affordable. Third, we need to come up with some way of knitting some of these layers together. If you are in the purchasing pool, this new fourth layer, and you suddenly lose your job at a small employer and your coverage is now picked up by Medicaid, which could happen, there needs to be a way to transition people smoothly. That needs to be done this year. And we need to get at least a down payment on mandatory spending for workforce, public health infrastructure, all of the system support activities that are simply integral to health reform if that insurance card is going to work for underserved and at-risk populations. Finally, we have to get the skeleton of information set. We have an IT investment that has started us off, but the most important issues to resolve are the issues of what information will have to be reported and to whom. Will we have a system where if you are running an immunization program, you will know about all of the children and adults in any of those four layers, their immunization status, whether they're due for an immunization? Will you be able to track population progress? Will you be able, if you need to look at individual patient progress for key subpopulations? Those are the kinds of critical down payments that need to be put into place this year. think of this as a, you know, 10-year job, but it will be a task that is far preferable to the current situation we face. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Rosenbaum. We do have time for some questions. Professor Rosenbaum did stick to the time that she promised, so we fortunately do have time for some questions. Lance, go ahead.
Hi, this is Lance Rodewald. Wonderful talk, of course, and it's always great to hear one of the primary architects of the VFC program talk at the immunization conference. Do you see any progress on the ERISA problem coming up with? Do you see any chance for progress on ERISA for covering immunizations?
For employer-sponsored plans,
right.
Yes. The problem that Dr. Rodewald refers to, of course, is the fact that in the current world, health plans that are offered by employers are totally exempt from any regulation whatsoever. Minor issues, but not much of anything. The assumption is that there may be probably some modest changes in what is recognized as a qualified employer-sponsored plan. I would say, though, you should expect that those kinds of changes are longer in coming. Over time, they will come, because the heaviest lift of all will probably be seen as whether those employers that don't offer any plan today will, A, be able to get their employees covered in this new fourth layer, and B, whether they're going to have to contribute something to the fourth layer. That is, that plus probably Medicaid restructuring and some essential Medicare restructuring are sort of the holy grail of this first year. And so I would say that we will revisit ultimately what is an employer-sponsored plan, but probably not right away.
Good morning, I'm Jim Buehler from Emory University. The Clinton effort fell victim to a well-orchestrated opposition, and already we see signs of opposition emerging with claims that this is socialism or socialized medicine and other forms of opposition. Why do you think that the chance of success will be different this time?
Let me stand up. I think that the chances of success are so different this time because, quite frankly, the state the country's in. Many people have made the observation, which is a key policy observation: never let a good crisis go wasted. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to overstate just in the past 2 days the sense that in 60 days we could see the backbone of American industry basically in bankruptcy, with millions of Americans' jobs on the line, and of course one of the most important aspects of the crumbling of the industrial economy we see going on is the millions of older workers, people 50 to retirement age, who are caught now in a terrible vortex. They have no job to go to. They will be forced into early retirement. And of course, when they went to work 30 years ago, they depended on retiree health benefits. Those are gone. And so the real crisis, the thing I think that will propel us forward this time as never before, is actually not the preventive needs of children, because we've been fortunate. In recent months, we've made more progress for children. But the real issue that will propel us on is this tremendous looming crisis for people 50 and over, as well as a Medicare program that, of course, now they're predicting will be, whatever the term means in the context of public policy, bankrupt in 2016. I think that's what's pulling us forward right now, which is why I noted to Dr. Rodewald that I don't really think that the issue of whether employer coverage is good enough is what is the urgency right now. It's terribly important. But the urgency is to create this fourth layer to catch people who, you know, we could be facing 60 to 70 million Americans without insurance in another 2 years, so.
Well, one more question.
Great. Sarah, thank you. It's over here, Ann Schuchat. You mentioned the Medicaid restructuring, you know, in the days ahead, and I wonder if you have any advice or homework for the VFC and immunization community. If there's Medicaid restructuring, is there anything that we need to be doing to really protect the legacy that VFC has had?
Well, my hope when I first worked on the VFC program was that actually, of course, it would be a universal program. It would not be a program only for publicly insured and uninsured children. I think the great lesson of VFC is that unlike other healthcare interventions, there is this very extraordinary sort of supply side and demand side issue, set of issues you need to think about. And what we really should be focusing on is, of course, creating a universal vaccine replacement program so that no clinical setting in which a vaccine should be administered becomes a missed opportunity. That vaccines are simply stocked, made available, the administration fee is correct. As the vaccine is administered, the right information goes into a system to capture the intervention. And I think the message at a minimum certainly should be that VFC should maybe become VFB. That is, that in a world in which all low-income people will get their subsidized insurance through Medicaid, which is where Congress seems to be headed, that any Medicaid beneficiary should be covered for ACIP-recommended vaccines using the kind of replacement or delivery system that the VFC program has established. So that would be my message, at least. Thank you so much.